So what's special about the Marines to you, Cameron?
Gosh, well, what's special about the Marines? Well, I did 10 years of active duty service in the Marine Corps, and ended up as a major in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is a very special group. It's like a fraternity, the likes of which the world has never seen. You end up with a group of men and women that come together and they bond through mutual suffering, mutual discipline, and a love for country. You know, there's this slogan about God, core, country. You know, it's
in that order.
In that order. Yes, in that order. So for me, it was a life-changing event to become a United States Marine.
I would suspect that that's true for everybody going through the Corps. The camaraderie and that common experience, where mm-hmm. wherever you may happen to go.
Absolutely.
It's intriguing for me, people who say they served. Where'd you serve? New York City. Okay. Part of what's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got the folks like you, you know, you're out there dodging bullets and avoiding all the mm-hmm. things that you need to avoid to take care of whatever the mission might happen to be. Mm-hmm. How do you avoid not becoming a recruiter?
There's no avoiding it. At all moments and all times, I just, you know, I love the Corps. I love what it did for me. Are there bad moments that happen in the Marine Corps? Yeah, there's certainly. But I will take those bad moments any day, any time that go along with those good moments. The camaraderie that you have in the Marine Corps, the sense of bigger purpose than yourself.
That's what I would think would almost be liberating.
Mm-hmm.
It focusing, but liberating at the mm-hmm. same time. You know, it's not just you.
Yes.
It's them. It's the guys around you. Yeah. It's everything.
Every day I always felt like I was making a difference, because I always felt like the Marine Corps was there as, it's a branch, it's an arm of the Navy there to protect the rights, the liberties, and the freedoms, the privileges that we do have as United States citizens. So every day, even the days I was sitting in the office writing fitness reports on Marines.
You mean there's paperwork in the Marine
Corps? Oh, yeah, lots and lots of it. But even those days, I did. I felt like I was making a difference. I knew we were sharpening steel even when we were doing paperwork, that we were, you know, men and women becoming better people for the betterment of the United States of America.
I would suspect that that's something a lot of folks who haven't gone through pick your branch.
Yeah.
The maturation that comes up. A couple of guys I went through high school with were doing some stunning things. They were like 19.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking, going, now wait a minute. I remember you in civics or in algebra 2. There's no way in the world I would trust you with anything valued close to that.
Right.
And now you're out there and you're knocking it through the uprights. Mm-hmm. Just that whole process of maturation must have been phenomenal, not only for you, but you see the new guy or gal coming in and you see how quickly they also
yes.
get to that same point.
It truly is amazing to me when you're out and about in everyday America and you see an 18-year-old and what our country kind of expects out of a regular, quote-unquote, regular 18-year-old. And then you get into the active duty Marine Corps and you see what is expected of an average 18-year-old Marine and what we give them, what we put in their hands, what we expect them to do every day.
Yeah, the responsibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to live like good young men and women, it is truly an amazing, it really is an amazing situation for me to see the difference. And, you know, we are expecting these young men and women these young Marines to protect our country, and we expect a lot out of them. So maybe we should expect more out of the average 18-year-old in this country.
What is the primary function of the Marine Corps?
The primary function of the Marine Corps is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. That's kind of the oath of office that we take. That's the first line of the oath of office that we take. And so every day we need to, as Marines, I felt like it was important to really think about that. What it is that, are we going to be able to support and defend that Constitution?
How familiar are you with the Constitution?
Not as familiar as I'd like to be. I'd like to be more familiar.
I mean, is that part of what the training is to understand, to embrace, but also to really understand?
It is, yes. But what's interesting about the Marine Corps, and this is that rabbit hole we're going to go down here for a minute. What's interesting about the Marine Corps is when you join any military branch, you actually give up your rights to the uniform code. You actually give up your rights as a citizen, and you become a servant to the uniform code of military justice. So it is an interesting situation in that you are no longer a citizen. You become you're now a branch of the military, and it's
you're almost a tool of the Constitution.
A tool of the citizenry, a tool of that Constitution, and a servant to that document. And there's nothing wrong with being a servant to that document. I do wish that we had actually learned more about it. I mean, the certain articles definitely were more important to Marines than others.
Oh, sure.
But it would be nice to learn more about that for the average Marine.
Yeah, somebody coming in to just kind of have a better sense about them. Yeah. Where do they fit in as far as the cog in the whole system? Now, you had mentioned earlier you were a major. Got 10 years. Why not? I don't know if the term is term out. Mm-hmm. Career. I mean, 10 is almost a career for a lot of folks.
Sure.
Yeah. Why not stay?
I love the Marine Corps. I actually had intended to stay. I actually resigned my commission because I was put into a situation where I needed to come home and raise my kids. I didn't necessarily want the children to be raised by the United States Marine Corps. That does happen. Well,
and that is a significant impact. I mean, the family life, the social life, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's when you hear either from military or paramilitary organizations where the shifting is going on, the kids are being uprooted all the time, and it's a factor.
Yeah. It's well, there's this joke, but it's serious. If the Marine Corps wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one. I mean, it's a joke, but it really is serious. It's hard on families.
Oh, I can't imagine. Let's say being stationed in Germany, and you learn that culture, but you're an American and you don't know the American culture. The challenges. I guess that's the simplest way. Well, and they say that it's family. You know, you don't sign up; it's family that signs up.
Oh yeah, it's definitely. They say it's not a career; it's a lifestyle. I think that's true.
Or a calling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost a genetic.
Yeah.
For me, with radio, I say it's a genetic weakness. Yeah. Perhaps you might want to use it a little slightly different, but that's kind of what it is. I mean, you think. There was a great quote we have in the sales end about Stephen King. Somebody had asked him once, so now that you're so rich and you made all this money and you're so famous, when are you going to stop writing? And his comment was, what makes you think I can? And that's so true. Kind of this whole element of it. Where did the term jarhead come from?
I'm not 100% certain. I think where it came from was Marines traditionally have a very squared away appearance, along with the haircuts. The haircuts were always a big deal.
Yeah, that's almost a signature. Mm-hmm. That and the snappy uniform.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Marines have been a critical part of embassy duty, security of Navy bases. For years, they were the drill instructors for not only the Marine Corps, but the Navy and the Coast Guard as well. So there was this image, this appearance, this expectation that Marines be very squared away. And I think that's where it comes from is, you know, the top of a jar is very square. I think that's where it comes from, you know.
Better than being called Corkhead, right?
Yeah.
What is the biggest frustration you have with maybe a false impression about the Marine Corps that the lay citizens or the general public have?
That's a good question. I think that there are definitely some times when, you know, not all Marines are definitely combat Marines. You know, it takes, you still have to have pencil pushers and administrators and not
cooks.
Every
don't forget the cooks, man.
Yeah, cooks, truck drivers. You know, you've got a lot of times you do have, that's probably my biggest source of frustration is the fact that not every Marine ends up in combat. But the irony is the slogans from World War I were, you know, first to fight. And so you do get a lot of people that do sign up. You get a lot of Marines that sign up in order to be in combat. And the reality of it is not everybody goes to combat. You have to have three Marines behind every infantryman in order to support an effective combat unit. So not everybody goes into combat. So not every Marine is going to have that experience. But it is a very unique group in that Marines sign up to go to combat. You end up with a very different group of people in the Marine Corps than you would, say, the Army, Navy, or Air Force, because most people want to be Marines to be that combat Marine. Most of them want to experience
kick down the door and go get
fight.
The bad guys. Yeah.
But that doesn't always happen. So I would say that's probably a big frustrating moment, not only for the average citizen that thinks that, oh, every Marine goes to war, right? No, that's also a frustration for a lot of Marines. They end up in the Corps and they're scratching their head wondering, how in the heck did I get stuck behind this desk?
Yeah, but it's like joining the Air Force and you're not a pilot.
Yes.
What? What do you mean I have to pump the tires?
Right.
Yeah. Oh. Any hesitation in recommending the Corps if there's a son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter who's considering, you know, particularly with all the goofiness that's going on now, maybe going that direction as a career path rather than going into college or, I guess, virtual college.
Right. I believe that not only the Marine Corps, but all military branches, it's not for everyone. Some people are geared much better to other things. Some people aren't geared for the military. And there are some times where you end up with Marines or troops that have really almost have no business being there. It does happen. But with regards to hesitancy, if there is somebody out there that thinks that they want to be a Marine, chances are they've got what it takes to be a Marine.
Well, and like you said, you don't have to necessarily be in the front. You could be the doctor.
Right.
Doing the triage and some of those types of things. Because I talk to a number of folks that are kind of like the guys that have their act together. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have some form of military in their background. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's the proofing stage or it's working their medal, whatever it might happen to be, there's something in there that just allows them then to go to the next step in their career. Whatever, if it's military, great. If it's something else, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting for me to see those consistencies.
I frequently had, this is kind of another rabbit hole here. I frequently had Mexican Americans. No, not even Americans. I frequently had Mexican Marines in my units. A lot of people don't really know that. You don't necessarily have to be a citizen of this United States in order to fight for this country. So and then a lot of these young men, Mexican men would, and women, Mexican men and women would come join a unit. They wanted to learn about America. They wanted to be citizens in this country. And so by joining the Marine Corps or joining a branch of service, you actually, it actually helped your path to citizenship. And I loved that because here you had these young people that just, they want to be Americans desperately. And they're willing to make a sacrifice for this country, even though it's not their country. They want it to be their country. And so on the back end, you end up with these fantastic immigrant citizens that learn a whole portion of what the United States is all about, that a heck of a lot of actual native-born Americans have no idea about.
Yeah, no clue. Yeah.
So that was always kind of exciting for me. The other thing that was always exciting, it still is exciting for me to watch, is to see when people come out of the military, all branches, the respect that they give and expect in return. And they emulate that. Simple things, like walking down the street and approaching another person coming down that same street, and the Marine or the former soldier will say to that other individual as they're approaching, "Good morning, sir." You don't get a whole lot of that. Yeah,
engaging
in every
people
day.
And looking at their eyes.
Yes.
Yeah, just normal, regular.
Yeah.
Well, for some of us, normal, regular things.
Right.
You're just. What does Veterans Day mean to you?
It's an exciting day. It's a good day. But at the same time, for the men and women that I know that have died in combat, it does bring back a lot of those memories. And so they're good memories and bad memories, because on the one hand, you know, you think about these people, you think about what their families went through, the things that the times we all shared, the things we all went through together. So there's the happy memories of it, but then you think, gosh, you know, I wish that person were still around.
And what they missed.
Yeah. Yeah,
not being able to live longer.
So it's a bittersweet holiday for me. It's very bittersweet because I love it, but I hate it at the same time, because it brings up good thoughts and really bad thoughts also.
A reflective day.
A very reflective day. Yeah.
Well, as long as it never becomes your favorite one, we're okay.
That's right. Yeah. I don't want it to be my favorite day.
Right. No. Are you available if somebody wants to, you know, have their kid or their grandkid come and talk with you a little bit?
Oh, absolutely.
I know you're kind of a moving target sometimes.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Absolutely. I am happy to talk about it, because a lot of times recruiters won't necessarily give you the whole story. You know, there's good parts and bad parts to the military, and when you're being recruited to enlist, it's not necessarily the bad parts that they really want to talk to you about.
Right.
The rough parts, the difficult parts.
Yeah. Cameron, Thanksgiving is one of those big family gatherings. I mean, for a lot of us, Thanksgiving is the family event. You know, Christmas, okay, we've got, you know, church, whatever form you may take with it, and it's a little bit more, well, reflective. Thanksgiving is a food holiday. It's an American holiday. It is everything. When people come in and say, "Hey, I'm going somewhere for dinner. What wine should I get?" Okay, Kemosabe. Now your fault or your victory if you hit. Where do you start with trying to come up with wines for Thanksgiving?
Well, generally, I will ask them, "Well, what are you going to be eating with for dinner tonight?" In this case, turkey. And it's going to be.
I know there are other choices
time
that some people have, but yeah, those are the wrong choices. So Thanksgiving, yeah, traditional game
traditional
on
Thanksgiving, yeah, dinner. When they come in, I will usually point them in a direction of a white. The white wines do bring out the flavor of that bird. The issue that does pop up is from time to time we get a lot of people that are, "Well, I want a red wine." And so a red wine with poultry, you're typically going to want to have something a little bit lighter. So a Grenache is a good choice, but
not the rosés.
Not the rosés.
Good, okay.
No. Yeah.
I still think that's kind of a mutation that should never have been really brought to market.
But right now, the Pinot Noirs, it's a light red wine. It's very well balanced. You can drink it with red meat, but also with white meat, but also with poultry or fowl. It's a phenomenal wine, and it's becoming very, very popular.
Yeah, that's kind of the trendy one now, isn't it?
As
Chardonnay was about 10 years ago.
Yes.
Pinot has now kind of filled that.
Yeah. The Chardonnays and the Cabernet Sauvignons, they're kind of the two pillars in the wine drinking business. The Pinot Noir is up and coming. The Merlots used to be extremely popular. They've kind of phased out, I think.
Because there's less market demand or less emphasis at the wineries and the vintners to make it. I mean, a smooth Merlot, you know, it's almost untouchable by anything else.
I agree. Merlot, Barbera, they're a fantastic wine. They're not necessarily as tannic as a Cabernet Sauvignon, but they're not as cool right now. And that's it.
It's just a trendy thing.
It's a trendy thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And there were a couple of movies that have come out lately, TV shows and movies that have talked about Merlots versus Pinots and that sort of thing. And it's, so what's happened is the trend is to move more towards those Pinot Noirs. I will say this though. Those Pinot Noirs from the Anderson Valley area in Mendocino, they're fantastic. And I would argue with anybody, that they are the best in the world. The fruit that comes from that part of Mendocino County, I'll argue with anybody that it's the best in the world.
Have you ever played the blind taste test?
My wife and I, and Dad actually, we actually do it home quite often.
Bring everybody into
it.
I would think that would be tough not to do it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you got the snob factor.
Oh, yeah.
With a label.
Yes.
You know, okay, now you've got, here's our five.
Yeah.
Here's your shot glass. Match it. I would be stunned if anybody got half.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's interesting for my family because I've got all these different labels on the shelf. There are many times where I'll find something and I will think to myself, that is a phenomenal wine. Why isn't it selling? I don't understand why it's not selling. So there have been many times where I'm like, okay, I'm taking this home and I'm going to put it next to, $200-$300 bottle of wine. And then I'm going to put it next to, say, you know, a $4 bottle of wine.
The box.
Yes. Yeah. And we'll drink them all. And it really is amazing. A lot of it is, it's mind games.
Yeah.
A lot of times, well,
actually,
marketing.
We prefer the term marketing. Yes.
Yeah, that's
mind
right.
Games, give me a break.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, you'll get these lower end wines.
Two-buck Chuck was a big deal, probably when you were in the service. But
yeah.
That it wasn't $2 quality. It was a whole lot better. But somebody just kind of slapped a cute little name on it.
Yeah,
and everybody was pleasantly surprised because you were expecting a $2 experience.
Right.
And it came in at a $15 or an $18 experience. Now, I probably have had a couple of samples of $200 bottles of wine. But they were friends providing it. I don't know if I could tell, or the uneducated palate, if you can tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know what you like, but the distinction between a $200 Merlot and a $50 and a $25.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of us, I would suspect it's the label.
Yeah. Yeah, I have had a few moments and experiences in my life, too, where I've gotten to crack open that really high-end bottle. And I will say, in some cases, I have been overwhelmed with joy as that bottle...
It gotcha.
Yeah.
The
flavor, the fruit that comes out of it, the whole experience... but then I've also had that same experience with lower end stuff where you're just overwhelmed with surprise almost at how good it is. So, yeah, I think it's definitely possible depending on conditions of the fruit, conditions of the fermenting process.
Well, and getting back to the Thanksgiving concept, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think a lot of folks understand a dessert wine versus the dinner wine versus the appetizer wine and how it flows. I mean, if there's the pairings and some of that kind of stuff, okay, fine. But But for regular guy or guy come in and say, okay, Cameron, turkey, baby, now what?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, here's a bottle. Instead of, well, here's the bottle that goes with the pumpkin pie. Here's the bottle that goes mm-hmm. with the meal. And here's the bottle that goes with the before.
For sure. I think a lot of it is you've got to ask the person a lot of questions. You know, we've got one mouth and two ears for a reason, right? So
you used that listen, line before, haven't you?
Oh, always. I use that with my kids almost every day. So yeah, asking a lot of questions, seeing what their experience is going to be like or what they expect out of their experience. You know, some people don't like to have three different types of wine over the course of their meal. Some people just want to have a bottle of wine or a varietal of wine for the entire meal. Other people want that aperitif. Other people want that dessert wine, that port. Maybe they are looking for a great, you know, port wine at the end of the meal. Maybe they're looking for a fantastic Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc to go with their turkey.
Now, I notice you haven't mentioned Riesling or Pinot Grigio here. I know they can tend to be overwhelmed, but I know at least one person that is looking for refreshing.
Yes.
That cool, crisp, clean, that's it. And not an awful lot of poundage, so to speak, with their wines. Are there opportunities for those types of wines to come into larger meals like this and not just be overwhelmed?
Yes. Most people I have found, they're just, a lot of times, if they're going to be together with family or friends, they don't necessarily want to take a big risk on the wine. But the fact is the Rieslings, the Gewurztraminers, the Viogniers, you know, some of the Chablis, the French Chablis, they're phenomenal white wines. And they're refreshing and they're fantastic. But a lot of times people, well, I'm going to be with my family, and maybe I'm going to play it safe. Okay, I know that Aunt Sally likes a good buttery Chardonnay. I'll grab a good buttery Chardonnay.
Sutter Holmes, thank you very much. Okay,
yeah,
fine.
That's right. Yeah.
Dessert wines are a whole different critter too.
Oh, they're great.
I don't like normal, right? So a dry peppery Gewurztraminer, to me, that's heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Had it once in 40 years of chasing. When you have particular properties that you're looking for, how difficult is it to find that combination? Is it? I know that's more like a wine buyer rather than a traditional wine retailer, but can you kind of start directing people in those directions?
You can. It is hard. Because a particular varietal can change from year to year substantially, because that fruit, it changes from year to year. If you've got a year with a lot of smoke in the air versus a year with a lot of sun or you know, a lot of rain, it changes that fruit from year to year. Now the reds,
that's okay, because you can let it rest.
Yeah.
No problem. With whites, it ain't going anywhere, baby.
Yeah.
You know, so I would think, I've had people tell me, if you like it, case it.
Yeah.
Buy multiple cases, store it, and if it's a white, drink it within 5 years because it's not going to get any better. In fact, it's probably going to start to degrade a little bit. Is that a good thought process?
It is. Yeah. Those whites, they don't last very long. White wines do not last very long. You don't necessarily want it to be extremely fresh. A little bit of aging is a good thing because it balances out the flavors. It balances out the fruit develops. It's a better situation to let it sit down for a little while. But after about, it depending on conditions, of course, after about 5 years, yes, you're right. It's
and don't put it over the fridge.
That's right.
As a storage area.
Yeah. Yeah. Keeping a
We've
nice,
had a couple
cool
experiences
place.
With that one over our years, and it's like, no, just kind of put it away somewhere mm-hmm. where you can see it. Now, with the reds is there a good, solid, not port, but red as a dessert wine?
On a red wine?
Yeah.
I mean, port is traditionally the best.
Right.
They do make some very nice Zinfandel sweet port-like wines that come out of the Central Valley area of California. And in fact, I'm really impressed with one right now called Terra d'Oro. And it is a Zinfandel wine made in the port fashion. So it's a very good wine. In fact, Jim Pastore is the one that turned me on to it. He said, you got to try this. And it's very nice. So they do make a few reds. And traditionally, what I've discovered is they are generally a Zinfandel with that nice sweet flavor to it. And usually they've got a nice high alcohol content too. So some people really, really appreciate that. Others don't necessarily care.
Right, going for taste to finish the meal off.
And I know that they have some darker muscats as well.
You know, that's an area I've never really gotten into. Is that a popular varietal, or is that one that has limited interest?
Yeah, it's not very popular in the U.S. It's something that's a little more popular in Europe.
A European wine, okay.
But here, it's not so much.
What about the Australians? I know that they're pushing a ton of product. Yeah. Do they stack up?
On the Sauv Blancs, yes. And arguably, the Australians make some of the best Sauv Blanc in the world.
Okay.
They put some really good product out that way. They are developing some pretty good Pinot Noirs also. But for me and in my experience, that's kind of where it ends with the Australians. Now, probably other people are going to argue, you're full of garbage, Cameron. You don't know what you're talking about. But from my experience, the Sauv Blancs from Australia are fantastic. In fact, I can't think of another location in the world that's as good as what they can produce.
Oh, really? Even better than the Oregon and the Washington?
I think so. Once again, matter of opinion. That's my opinion.
Now, are we going to have little stickers at both of the shops saying Cameron Selection 4?
I've thought about doing that, and I should do that, and I need to do that.
For Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. Yeah, I have three or four of them, so we don't have to be making notes as we listen to this a second time.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
There you go. You got one out of this so far. Okay. All right, Winston, that's for the Thanksgiving. We'll wrap and play with that one. And then I think for the holidays, it's more hard liquor, isn't it?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Okay, so we can kind of kick to that side of the store for this, and then we'll meld them together for New Year's or figure something out down the road with that. Okay, so this one, I guess, would start... What do you want, Di, after Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the 27th out.
There's not that long in between. Just a couple weeks, really.
Yeah, it's to go for a couple of weeks, yeah. Okay, here we go. Hard booze, 3, 2, 1. What is magic about, you know, when you say adult beverages, most people define it as something that's got an ice cube in it. And there's the tequila as a set-aside, but by and large, there's ice cubes involved. What separates one from another? I know, obviously, there's taste, but let's say vodka and tequila is kind of where I play. What separates the difference? Is it as simple as price point?
I don't think it's price point at all. I think what separates it is personal preference and trend as well. So there is... I've seen it in just a couple of years that I've been involved in the liquor stores where trends definitely come and go. Right now, bourbon is crazy, crazy trendy. People want to drink bourbon, and they're willing to spend big dollars for bourbon. I don't necessarily, personal taste, I don't necessarily care for bourbon. I love a great rye whiskey. Other people... Like you just said, other people want the vodkas and the tequilas. Tequila is also right now extremely hot. People are willing to spend big money for a good sipping tequila.
And there's plenty of opportunities to do that.
Yeah. Oh,
it's amazing the variety, just the shelf space that some of these take. Obviously, you know that everybody has a following and they're earning their keep, so to speak. But it's a mystery for me.
There are some phenomenal tequilas out there right now. And what's funny, though, is a lot of celebrities have gotten into tequila. And so you've got Michael Jordan that's got a a tequila. You've got George Clooney that's got a tequila. You've got the Jonas Brothers that have their own tequila. It keeps going and going and going. And you wonder, well, why the heck is that happening? And
because land is cheap in Mexico.
There you go. Yep.
I mean, that's one thing. Yep. I do know. Tequila is like champagne. It's from a region, and that's it. Yeah. And if it's not there, it's not tequila.
Yeah, and a lot of these guys, a lot of these famous folk can go down to Mexico, and for a relatively decent amount of money, they can get their own label going and start something and peddle it in the United States, and they get to make a little money. And maybe they write it off as a business expense, and they get to give, you know, bottles of their own product to their friends. And
wouldn't that be weird? Cameron's Best?
It would be very weird.
I don't know. I don't think anybody would pick up Pabstein's Best and say, okay, we'll just kind of put that one over in the corner. Oh, boy. For somebody who is not that familiar, how do you try to establish what areas you like? Short of going in with like $10,000 and you buy a bottle of everything and you go home and you just start trying each one.
I think you got to make a lot of mistakes. That's what I've done. You know, you bring in something.
You sure you want to confess that one?
No, I don't. You know, you'll bring a bottle of something home and try it. And it sometimes, you know, it's a slam dunk. Oh, this is fantastic. Why haven't I been drinking this for years? And then other times, you bring something in, and this tastes, you know, you'll drink it, you'll try a taste, and this tastes like burnt hair and carpet or something. And so this
you,
is
you
garbage.
Hope it doesn't screw up the drain as you're pouring it in the sink. Yeah.
some of the stuff that's out there is garbage. Why waste your time on garbage? And then others are just fantastic. And sometimes you'll open a bottle of something, and maybe it's a $34 bottle of rye whiskey, and you pour it out, and you take a drink of that, and you realize, oh my gosh, this is one of the best kept secrets on the market right now. Other times, you know, you find yourself taking home something that cost you $80, and you try it, and it's okay. I think I just got burned on $80, but I think a lot of experimentation. I mean, be willing to try new things.
The little airplane bottles that we see other people ordering when we fly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, other people, of yeah, course. Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
good. Never, I'm glad I didn't lose the language on you. Yeah. Are those enough? I mean, would that be a recommendation? Yeah. Buy, you know, whatever color you want or whatever type you want, and buy four or five different types and see if that's really where you want to go, and you're spending certainly a lot less before you go hog wild.
Yes. I think it's a great way to go. I know when I am trying new things and bringing in new options, I truly don't drink very much. I'll take a little sip. You can figure it out pretty quickly. You get the nose, you get the palate, you get that aftertaste, but then come back to it. Because a lot of times your mind can be playing tricks on you with things.
Yeah, you want to confirm it.
Yeah. Yeah. So an airplane bottle is a good place to start. If you're experimenting and you want to try new things, yes, I think it's a great way to go. Because then you're not stuck with a bottle of something that you don't like. And why drink something you don't like?
Well, it's really tough to re-gift it once you've opened it.
Yeah, that's
not right. That I've ever tried that, but gee, Dad, thanks.
Yeah.
So what are some of the traditional adult beverages for Christmas? A lot of us still do the turkey thing.
Yeah.
Is there a pairing, to use the wine referencing, is there a pairing with turkey that tends to be from the liquor cabinet?
Not necessarily. I do think that the lighter spirits traditionally, the lighter spirits and the darker spirits traditionally do go in line with a wine, traditionally. But it's really about personal preference and what you like as a consumer. because
because you can always put the lid back on these things, and it's not going to go bad like a wine will once it's corked. It's game on at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are whiskeys out there that have a nice, you know, grain feel to it, or a weeded feel to it, that would probably be fantastic with turkey. And then you've got nice clean vodka, and depending on if you're mixing that off with something, I mean, that could be a phenomenal pairing as well.
Now, roast beef probably is the more traditional for a lot of folks, you know, unless they go old fashioned with a goose and that kind of stuff for dinner on Christmas Day. Traditional pairing with that? I mean, I would think the bourbon that you were talking about and some of the whiskeys mm-hmm. would tend to be more typically consumed at that time.
I know the Renner family tradition is we will typically...
And often?
That's right. All right, it's noon. We can start drinking now. When we first show up, it'll traditionally be, all right, come in the door. What do you want for a cocktail? My mom will drink vodka. My wife drinks vodka. My dad and I, we traditionally will drink like a scotch or a rye. My brothers, they're traditionally rye drinkers. And then we will transition. So cocktail hour goes, well, maybe a couple hours, couple cocktail hours, then transitions into wine with the meal. And then we have found we've been closing out the meals with either a dessert wine lately or a limoncello or some kind of a
liqueur. I was going to ask about some of those new creations that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Seems weird. I don't think I've ever tried one, at least not on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just the changing palate or changing desires in the marketplace?
I think so. There are some phenomenal liqueurs that are coming out of some of our local distilleries around here. There's a limoncello by Dutch and Dewey that I think is fantastic. There is a chocolate liqueur by Eureka Chocolate Liqueur that is just, I can't keep it on the shelves. And
limited production?
It's a limited production. The distillery only makes it around the fall holiday season. If you want it, boy, people better come and get it now because it's not going to be around much longer. But it is fantastic. It's blended off with Dick Taylor chocolate. It's a very, very nice dessert /
a true dessert aperitif. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of the local, so there's some great liqueurs that are being made by the local distilleries. The limoncellos, I that's become my thing. I will end almost every meal anymore with a little bit, just a little, maybe 1 ounce shooter of limoncello, and it just that
it goes well with French fries and hamburgers.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know about that. But the limoncellos are great. You know, there's that zesty fruit that comes out of the lemon, and it just helps me personally, like it settles my stomach.
It's almost like a palate cleansing the system. Yeah.
Yeah, it's become a lot of fun trying a lot of different dessert liqueurs and wines.
The other traditional obviously is beers.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you see the marketing ramps up and some of the stuff. I mean, to me, Christmas is still Ed McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the Clydesdales and hearing here comes the king of beers, this jingle from the 60s. That, to me, is part of what Americana at Christmas is. A little bit of snow and the jingle bells, the whole nine yards, and sleigh bells. With beers, there's a lot of seasonality with beers, special releases. I know Sam Adams was one of those that was out in front on that kind of stuff, and they got a gazillion different options. How do you determine what beers you're going to put on your shelves in the seasonal area?
I flip a coin. It really, I will say this. A lot of times the reps will come in and say, hey, what do you think about this? And I'll give them a taste. Some of them, it's like, oh, man, this is easy. Bring it in. This is going to be very popular. Others, you know what? It's a seasonal. We'll make a space for it. We'll see how it does.
Yeah, give me the 4-case minimum and let's see what if it moves.
We'll try it out. You know, some of these seasonal beers, though, they're just fantastic.
You're not talking about the fruity beers, are you?
Well, I can't do the fruity beers. I'm not a fruity beer. And in fact, I have a hard time with a lot of the seltzers. But some people love these seltzers. That they are so popular.
Yeah, you can tell the footprints in all the stores. They're pretty big. So yes. Obviously they're punching through. I've not seen like what AB sales have been for the Bud seltzers. But I mean, you just see, and you know, some people are buying that up.
Bud Light makes a seltzer right now. It's very popular. There's a natural seltzer. But the one that is just killing it out there.
Less filling or better taste?
Yeah. I think that's the point. I think a lot of that's why the seltzers are so popular is because there's a decent essence or taste behind it, and it is extremely low carb. I think that's the point. I think that's why a lot of people like that option. And a lot of people too will maybe take a They'll mix it into a cocktail. They'll take that White Claw and give it a shot of vodka and make it into a harder cocktail that way. I really can't believe how popular they are. I mean, if you're not making a seltzer right now, you're way behind the times.
Yeah, you're outside the house instead of inside the house with everybody.
And I gotta say, Eel River Brewery, they were way ahead of everybody else on this. They started making the Clarity. And they were way ahead of everybody on it. Good for them. I mean, a local brewery that saw this vision, and they did it right.
Okay, Winston, I think covers that part. I want to do one segment on champagnes.
Okay.
Either for New Year's or you can integrate it wherever you want to. But so we'll have one last segment here. About 10 minutes worth?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. 3, 2, 1. Cameron, one of the things that I think is one of the more traditional areas for a lot of us are champagnes. And we have folks in Sonoma County that do a great job, at least for a lot of us. They do a great job. And then you got the real deal. And then you got the Italian sparkling. And, you know, everybody has their take on it. For you, what is the ideal champagne?
The champagnes that come out of the Champagne region of France, they're fantastic. They definitely let you know it. You know, you pay for that.
Bottles and, with an attitude.
That's right. And the French, they've got good reason, in my opinion. They've got good reason to be a little arrogant when it comes to champagne. They really do. That my wife and I actually, that's where we took our honeymoon, was the Champagne region of France. And we got to try some stuff that just will knock your socks off and stuff that will never come to America because they're happy having their product in their own country. The other sparklings that come out of Italian, the Proseccos.
There's some of those that are just, I mean, for me, because I like a really dry. Yeah, I don't want the sweet. I don't want the aftertaste. I want just the event. Some of the Italians are, for me, superior.
They're fantastic.
To the French. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the nice thing about the Proseccos is 9 times out of 10, they're going to be less money. And it's really
significantly good, less money.
Significantly less money. Yeah. And it is very good sparkling wine. And I think that those Proseccos are actually becoming arguably more popular than the champagnes, because that price point.
Right, as a regular rather than a celebratory?
The products that are made here in California, also very nice. Korbel makes it. They make a great sparkling wine.
Korbel is extremely dry for, that's the one we get, well, it used to be called extremely dry. I don't know what it's called. You know, they keep changing. That's what really torques me.
I mean, Brut versus extra dry.
No,
versus,
they keep changing the labels.
Oh, yeah.
And the
yeah.
references. So you get used to something, and then you go in the next time, and it's like, oh, no, that's.
Yeah.
This is what we think is the exchange. It's like, no, I want what I want. Come on. But the marketing of that stuff. But the Korbel stuff, has got to stack up pretty well to any of the other American products.
Yeah. In my opinion, it's very, very nice. And once again, price point. You know, you can get a $12, $13 bottle of Korbel that's very, very nice. And you could place it right next to a Prosecco, right next to a champagne, and you're in there.
Good to go. Yeah. It's always curious for me with the sport events, right? You know, they get the fancy bottles and they're popping all over the place. I bought one bottle of those once, and it was like, yuck, you kidding me? This is the standard? It was so sweet and had such lingering. I mean, it was like the antithesis of what we want. And okay, fine. That's for that other crowd. That's not for our crowd.
Yeah.
And just not worry about it. But there is a snobby associated with champagne. And to me, it's almost as if that should be the everyday wine rather than some of the others that, you know, I don't know how it didn't get there. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it did early on and things changed. How many champagnes do you carry? I mean, do you want a couple dozen of them on the shelves just to touch everybody's palate?
Yeah. Because like with wine, it's personal preference and taste. You've got the demi-secs, which are extremely sweet. You've got those bruts and extra dries that are most people prefer those drier champagnes.
Oh, really?
By far and away. Okay. I find the sales at the stores are significantly greater for a drier champagne than a sweeter champagne. Significant. But, you know, every once in a while, it's nice to have a nice, sweet sparkling.
Well, as a dessert rather than a regular.
That
I could almost
allow. I also find that a lot of, like, baby showers or wedding showers, a lot of the female demographic definitely likes sweeter than the male demographic. That's for sure. I definitely find
you didn't even feel yourself going out on that edge, did you?
But as far as the numbers, you've got to have a good selection, because the reality of it is people like the different flavors. Just like when they're selecting a good bottle of wine or a good bottle of liquor, they want some choice. Some bottles will affect others in a different way. You know, I know in my family, I've got a few family members that cannot drink certain brands of product. It will give them a headache. And so, you definitely need different choice for different people. I think on the shelf, I probably have just a shot in the dark. I'm guessing I'd say between 20 and 25 different sparkling wine types.
Well, it's got to get most folks, it's got to get close.
Yes, yeah.
To what they want, yeah. Why don't they make magnums or splits for champagne? I mean, there are some of the magnums, and, you know, they got like four or five digits associated with them. But, you know, rather than buying two bottles, get one larger one, or if there's only like two of you, and you just want a glass, a split. I mean, are those just marketing decisions that go on, or is there a chemical reason that you need to have a certain mass for things to be able to ferment properly?
No, it's strictly a marketing issue. It's strictly what people will buy. There are small bottles, there are large bottles. A lot of times, though, you know, people look at that large bottle and they'll say, I don't want to look like an alcoholic walking out of here with this giant bottle. Like, are you serious? But you got, okay, all right. Yeah. You know you're going to drink
instead.
All this.
Take three instead.
You know, it's a beautiful bottle. It's a great presentation and look great. I don't know that I want to do that. And then, the small bottles actually do sell pretty well.
Do they? Good.
Yeah. Usually they just kind of get hidden away, and you can kind of get them in little four packs or six packs. They definitely, they're out there, but it is, if you're unable to find them, it's 90% of the time, it's because whoever's doing the purchasing for that store
just hasn't.
Yeah.
Well, so I would think, you know, as we were talking about the taste testing with others, be able to sample a series of champagnes. You can't get the itty bitty bottles typically with champagnes. but you don't want to get hammered. So the fourth one you try, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be seltzer water, and you're going to have the same comment. But to have those, because I have not figured out how you can recork a champagne bottle.
Nope.
You know, when the mushroom comes out at the top, it's over. You know, and you better like what it is, or your plants better like what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it just is intriguing. But you can order, or if you order a case, okay, that's pretty standardized in most people's heads.
Mm-hmm.
Can you order a case of splits? Is it 12?
You can.
Is it 24, 36? I mean, what number
Depends on the brand, but it's usually 24.
Yeah. Okay.
And, in fact, I've got a few of those in the store. Ruffino, Prosecco, and Korbel, actually, and I think I even have some Cooks. So, you know, kind of a decent little spectrum there. But as far as the higher-end stuff, doing splits with the higher-end stuff, because it is, you know, a lot more money, and it's a much more of a bigger risk if you bring in a Moet or a, you know, Tattinger or a, you know, one of those. You're paying a lot more money if you do get something smaller, and it's more of a risk. So I think a lot of people don't necessarily want to tie up those dollars in something that might sit there for a while.
Right. But if somebody wanted to buy one case of Pickett, then that's pretty readily available.
Yeah. If somebody wanted to come and buy a case of, Moet or something like that. Oh, absolutely. Chandon, something like that. Yeah, no problem. It's definitely available. It's there for the purchase, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, you know, if it's just a regular dinner and you don't want to have a big bottle every night, you get one of the smalls, and then you're able to take care of business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else you want to say?
This is Cameron Renner from Harris & K and Ferndale Liquors wishing everybody a fantastic Thanksgiving this 2020.